Whether you keep them in your home or love to see them in theirs, these are the creatures that bring us all together.
Reptiles. We're going to be delving into the experiences of reptile lovers from around the block and around the world. This is the Reptile Talk Podcast. What's up, everybody? This is Jeremy Turgeon from Brass Man Reptiles.
And I'm Rob, and I'm creeping it real.
So this is going to be a super fun episode because while we're recording, we're also recording live on Instagram.
On Instagram!
And we had a little bit of a Q&A. We're going to be chatting with our Instagram audience today. Hopefully Instagram, the Instagram update was real and there's no time limit. Yeah. Otherwise, it will end very abruptly for them, and I apologize in advance. But if you're not already, make sure you're following us on Instagram at reptile.talk.
Yes.
And you can see random stuff like this. And
make sure that you follow us on OnlyFans.com. We have got an OnlyFans account for Reptile Talk. It's OnlyFans.com/Reptile Talk. And what we'll be doing is we'll be sharing some behind-the-scenes stuff, some footage, some little clips and things of me and Jeremy doing sound checks and some of the projects that we're working on. We're hatching out babies. We're going to post them there before we post them on social media. So it's kind of like a little behind-the-scenes little community. We're actually going to be posting some polls up on there, too. So if you want to help us choose what our next episode is for just us, or if you have suggestions for people who you'd like to see on the show, join us on OnlyFans and you can throw in the hat right in there.
Bam.
So
today.
Tonight.
Tonight. This evening.
Yeah.
Our viewers have taken a vote here on Instagram. So we're going to be talking about some of the differences between keeping a smaller scale collection versus a larger scale collection. So just to kind of give some parameters or ideas, a small scale collection, what are we saying numbers-wise?
I'd say anything under like maybe 30 or 50.
Okay.
Anything under that is generally considered like a smaller scale. Like you might be the weird reptile person in your town, but as far as like reptile community goes, a lot of people, either they've got, 10 reptiles or they've got 150 or 200 reptiles.
It's like shit, bro.
There's not a lot of people that are in between, Hey, I'm just saying.
So there's also the funny part about this is it's literally like Rob's collection next to my collection.
Yeah. I mean, I have a medium sized collection.
Yeah. But I have three times as many snakes as Rob does.
That's
and that's literal.
Yes, literally.
That is also
he counted.
Very
that's the capital rule. If you have a large collection, don't count actual numbers.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah. I did only because my entire set of baby bins was full.
Was full.
And I was very nervous because that right there was 90 drawers. And I was like, hey, there's more snakes than just that in this room. How many more are there? There was a lot more, guys.
Oh, my goodness. So many snakes.
Oh, man. So I think it's fair to say if you're just getting started in keeping reptiles, you're going to have a small collection.
Yeah.
Unless you magically end up taking over somebody's collection if something ever happens, which is never
That's
really the
tough.
Greatest idea.
It's really tough.
So I know for me personally, when I first started keeping reptiles, I grew my collection pretty quickly, but I kind of hovered around the 20 to 30 animals for a while. And I mean, the biggest thing is the time commitment.
Yes.
Right up front. I mean, it was really easy. I mean, back then I kept everything in tanks, but it was really easy
The olden days. Trust me, I remember. That was me.
So, I mean, that was probably the most time consuming part of cage maintenance was taking a screen lid off, moving lights, all that stuff, trying to get into the cage. I remember having like a big 55-gallon tank for like one of my, I had like this monster ball python. I had in this 55-gallon tank, but it was also on the top level of this rack. So I had to get on a ladder all the time to get up. It's horrible.
A 55 horrible. On a stand?
Oh, dude. I got one of those town fair tire racks. So like those heavy duty industrial ones.
Oh,
I got it for
God.
Free.
Oh.
And like moved that into my snake room. Mm-hmm. And I had it fit everything.
Yeah.
It was perfect. Except for that one cage.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
And I'm much happier with the rack systems for sure. But the time commitment was certainly the biggest difference, then compared to now. Even though it doesn't take me much time-wise to get through what I have. to be able to do everything needed in that room in an hour, hour and a half, is certainly much easier when you throw in the rest of life's ordeals, you know, like school and part-time job and whatever. Now it's like a whole day of mine gets kind of thrown away. But of course it's not, I mean, it's not truly thrown away because I enjoy it, and I'm not just doing cage maintenance. You know, I'm talking with people on social media, I'm posting pictures on Instagram or Facebook, and then people are asking me questions. So there's that interaction that happens too, and it ends up taking a large portion of the day. But it's definitely hard because throughout the week, I'm still coming in and taking care of my stuff too, making sure things have water and all that stuff. So working a full-time job and then coming to work essentially another
full-time job
is a big thing to take into consideration as you're growing your collection. Because it adds up quick. And when you fall behind.
Yeah. And it's not really fair for the animals, because, you know, you got to figure you're their sole source of care. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, one of the things that people kind of idolize and people really look up to or want to do is like, I want to have like a full snake room. I want to have like a full reptile room without, you know, really considering how much of their time is going to go into, you know, taking care of these animals and changing waters and, you know, doing full enclosure cleans, you know, periodically. And because, you know, a lot of people will spot clean, and it's easier to do with certain species and all that sort of stuff. But you got to do full cleans every now and again, where you just like take everything out, scrub it all down, you know, bleach it, do whatever you got to do, chlorhexidine. And that is a very, very time consuming. And, you know, having a big collection of reptiles is very interesting because you get to see a variety of different reptiles. But it is also a huge, huge, huge commitment. And going from looking at a small collection of reptiles, or someone might have, you know, 10 animals or whatever, or, you know, even just like 5 animals. If you've got 5 animals that you're putting all of your time and resources into, you know, if they flip their water dish, that's easy because you're not stretched thin for time. When you've got 100 animals and 10 of them flip their water dishes, now you've got 10 full enclosure cleans that you've got to do, mm-hmm. on top of making sure that everybody else has water, everyone else is getting fed, everyone else is getting spot cleaned. So it's something that you definitely have to take into consideration. And a lot of people, you know, it doesn't come up as the first thing that you think about when you think about a big size reptile collection. You know, and once you get over 50 animals, it can very easily be a full day of cleaning, like full from the time that you wake up and go into your reptile room until you're getting ready to go to dinner and settle down for the day. It can be a full day of cleaning if you've got those numbers of animals. Where
sometimes there's no dinner.
Yeah, sometimes, a lot of times, there's no dinner.
It's just you collapse at the end of the day.
You lay down and you're like, that was satisfying, but man, I'm tired.
Yep, exactly. Gone. Out for the count.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's just something that you have to take into consideration. And I feel like that's something that doesn't get talked about as much. Like, people are starting to talk about more, if you've got a large collection, you might see illness more frequently. You might see weird things. Like, I've had people contact me and they're like, what is this weird growth on my animal? I'm like, oh, it might looks kind of like cancer. Like, I'm not a vet, but that looks like a cancerous tumor that has grown and expanded, and, you know, you probably should take it to a vet. And the odds of that happening if you've got 4 animals, probably not that high.
Right.
You know, it might happen, but it probably isn't all that high. If you've got 300 animals, the chances that you're going to see cancer at some point, probably it's going to happen. Like, yeah. I wouldn't doubt that it's going to happen, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm checking the chat. So people in our Instagram chat, I've opened it up. So if anybody wants to ask us questions on this topic, they can. And Jessica Garrett has asked, would you say more people start small, not necessarily intending to get large and gradually change, or more often people have a plan to execute the plan and become large? I think, at least from what I've seen over the years, it's most people, they get into it not necessarily with an intention to get large scale, but like most people start off with ball pythons, so they get like 1 or 2, and then they get hit with the breeder bug, and then they start to get a few more, and they get really excited about those, and before they know it, they've got 30 or 40 snakes.
Yes.
You know, and or more in some cases. I've seen some people literally go from zero snakes to 150 snakes in 6 months' time. And, you know, not anything I recommend at all. You know, and so I think that's usually the way it goes. Or you get the person that, like, they just get, like, a bearded dragon. And they're like, I just want this cool pet because it's a pet for me. It's going to be my pet. And, you know, they might get one or two other reptiles along the way because they like them. And that's about it. And so I generally see that more often happening now as things have kind of shifted to like the bioactive, big, huge enclosure kind of deal. Like most people don't have space for a bunch of 4x2x2 enclosures.
Yeah.
You know, so I see a lot more people kind of doing that. But of course, there's still the people who, like I said, with, you know, they get bit by the breeder bug with ball pythons and then they get a couple rack systems and they have a bunch of snakes. You know, the irritating thing when I see that happen is more often than not, they just don't understand that commitment of time.
Yeah.
And then they start asking for help. They start like, I don't have, and like, it's like, well, you don't have the time, but you don't even know what the time commitment is.
Yeah.
Like you've never had to invest it. So, you know, it literally means you have to make personal sacrifices to do what you want to do. You know, I think back on my own journey, keeping a larger scale collection, literally being like, no, guys, I can't hang out today because I got to feed snakes.
A lot of times.
You know, and then your friends get mad at you.
I used to tell my friends, look, if you want to hang out, you can come over while I feed snakes. And luckily, my friends were like, yeah, fucking, why not? Let's do it. So they would, like, hang out at my house while I was feeding snakes. And, you know, they kind of let me do my thing. But a lot of people are not cool like that.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, I had a lot of band friends in high school. So they're like, a couple of them would be like, yeah, cool, we'll hang out, do some snake stuff, whatever. But most of them were like, nah, man, we want to go like hang. Like, let's go to the Big E or, you know, we want to go do X, Y, Z. And I'm like, I don't have the time. Yeah, I can't. Sorry. Do that. You know.
Yeah.
And I always had my stuff like on a pretty solid schedule. So like Thursday was always my cleaning day. Mm-hmm. And everybody would want to do something on a Thursday. And I'm like, God damn it, guys. Sorry. Like, sorry. I can't do it. So, you know, I mean, you have to make those sacrifices. So that's probably the one thing when somebody gets a massive collection really quickly that irritates me, because more often than not, they're not aware or prepared, for that time commitment. And then they immediately just start seeking out help. And then it's like, well, I mean, what have you ever done on your own? You know, you have to do something. You have to understand this a little bit, you know, especially if you're then trying to breed.
Yeah.
You know, like the number of animals you have is not going to get smaller.
As soon as those babies start poking out their heads out of those eggs, that is more time commitment for that. So it's like, whew, it's something that you definitely have to take into consideration. And then one of the major things that I think about is your feeding bill for those animals that you're interested in getting, because they're not going to just feed themselves. You have to buy the food to take care of those animals. And, you know, for certain snakes, you know, it might not be a crazy high feeding bill. You know, bloods and short tails, they don't eat a ton. You can feed them a ton, but realistically, they're not probably meant to eat a ton all the time.
Yeah.
But if you got baby corn snakes now, you know, you hatch out 30 or 40 corn snakes, you know, one or two clutches. Now you got 40 mouths that got to eat every 5 to 7 days, minimum. Like, they need it. They're little shoelaces. They need it.
Yeah, exactly.
So you really have to stay on top of that and consider that. I get a lot of people who are like, I want to breed things. And I'm like, just think about the feeding bill before you try to sell them. Because just to get them to the point where you have to sell or you're going to try and sell them, you're going to have to probably put a couple $100 of food into your clutch.
Yeah,
or litter.
At least.
Or whatever you're producing. You're going to have to put a decent amount of money up front just to be able to sell them. So that's something that a lot of people don't even think about. Like, they're just like, I want to breed them. And it's like, it's more than just that.
It's more than just that, yeah. And I think Jessica just chimed in with another comment that I think is really solid. She says, I believe the hobby is getting very large very quickly in the past few years, especially with the expanding of herpers, breeders, and enthusiasts. It's getting big too quick. I don't think it's getting too big too quick. I think we're just seeing the expansion more publicly. Because if I think back from, like, I don't know, I got my first snake 16 years ago. So if I think about MySpace, you know, ain't nobody on MySpace talking about, look how many snakes I have, no. You know. But that doesn't mean a bunch of people weren't getting into snakes. It was certainly, like, nobody was going out buying a banana ball python 16 no. years ago, no. you know, in your local neighborhood for the most part. But, you know, now the average prices for reptiles has come down quite a bit. And the world is literally controlled by social media, you know, so we all the time we see breeders, you know, that are just out there doing their thing and not to, you know, not to downplay any of them at all. You know, but like, if I think about some immediate people that I was just like going through, scrolling through videos today, Billy at Mutation Creation, Miguel at Always Evolving Pythons. Of course, Brian Barchek. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, you've got us at Nerd. You know, you think about all these guys from varying levels. You know, I don't think Miguel's got a decent sized collection, a couple hundred snakes, yep. I think. Billy's got around 1,000 or so. And then, obviously, Barchek's got like 5,000 snakes, and we're a bit more than that.
Yeah, probably much more than that, yeah.
You know, but... like, those are just literally just four names of people that are showcasing what they're doing for in any context, from breeding and producing really cool ball pythons to showing and trying to educate people about a multitude of different species. But we see it so much now. It's way easier for somebody to be like, oh, man, like, that snake is really cool, because YouTube's right at our fingertips. Yeah. Instagram's right at our fingertips, yeah. You know. So it'd be like, oh man, like, that snake's cool. What is it called again? Go back in the video and figure out what it's called and then go find it, you know? And they're like, oh, it's only $300. That's not too bad. I got that for my birthday, you know, like, and then they have an animal, you know, which is cool in one regard, because it's cool at how easily accessible the hobby has become. It's not as taboo as it was 20 years ago to the general public.
Yes.
But you know, I mean, it's very similar to like what I deal with when teaching music, is like, man, like, you don't understand what even the people who came before my generation and the generation before that had to learn. They had to go to a record store, pray to God that record store had that record in stock, and then you had to purchase it. It wasn't cheap. Then you'd have to go and play it. There was nothing to slow down the music. Mm-hmm. If you were trying to learn something, you had to learn it at full tempo. If you tried to slow down a record on a record player, it changed the key of the music, so it didn't work.
Yeah,
you know. Versus now, you're like, oh, I heard about this artist, I want to check out their new record. YouTube, Spotify, Pandora, and it's like, bam, it's right there.
And they've got it with no vocals, slowed down. They got somebody who's doing a thing, a tutorial on how to play it.
Yep, and you're like, exactly. And you're like, and then it's like, well, I don't want to practice. God, it's so easy now. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like same thing for reptiles. You know, like, you buy a ball python, you want to start breeding ball pythons, but you literally have no understanding of ball pythons other than what you see
online. I see that a lot. Yeah, people just get into it and they're like, I like this pretty snake. I got this other snake. I'm going to breed them. And then they contact us and they're like, well, what did I hatch out? And I'm like, well, you didn't research any of that? You didn't do any research at all?
Yep.
You just want me to tell you?
Yeah, exactly.
That's not good.
No.
Not good.
Nope.
I think that the hobby in general is going in a more positive direction for the sole reason that as it's growing and becoming less taboo, it appeals to a wider audience of people. And when you've got that wider audience of people, it's less likely to get kind of squashed out. Like right now, animal rights activists and people who are like in PETA and stuff like that, they really, really, really want to regulate against the exotic animal community. I'm using heavy air quotes right there because they're exotic and they belong in the wild. And they really have been pushing a lot of regulation to try and ban you know, reptiles and amphibians, and they've succeeded in a couple different fashion of bringing regulations up that have got consideration from the federal government. Yeah. And some of it hasn't passed, and then they've been working on some things that have passed. And the more people that are involved in the community as a whole, the harder it'll be for people like PETA to push through those regulations. Because if lawmakers and the government, if they don't know anyone who keeps reptiles, they're going to go, ugh, a snake, ugh, get rid of it. Like, why would anyone want to keep a snake anyway? When I went to the Maine, I was involved in the state of Maine going to their Inland Fisheries and Wildlife Department as they were trying to change their regulations up there. And literally, their reasoning for not wanting to allow more species of snakes, because Maine has got such heavy restrictions on exotics. It's crazy. But their main reason, like when I asked them, why can't I have, like, at the time I wanted to have my Spilotes, my tiger rat snakes. I wanted to bring them from Massachusetts where they're legal, and like every other state around where they're legal. I just wanted to bring that legal snake in every other state to Maine with me. And they were like, you can already have snakes. Why are you even complaining right now? Because you can have a corn snake and a ball python. And I'm like, that's not the same. That's not the same. And they just like, they don't understand at all. And that's another thing that you got to think of if you're looking at having a smaller collection or a bigger collection, is legality for where you are. Because, you know, I think it was in Massachusetts. I can't even remember who told me this. I think it was like Andy. Mm-hmm. He was like, did you know that in the state of Massachusetts, if you have more than four of the same animal, you're legally considered an animal hoarder? And I was like, well, they probably shouldn't know how many Borneos I've got, because I've got like 30 of them. But legally speaking, if you've got a large collection, that is something that could be brought up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not likely to get brought up, but theoretically it could get brought up against you. And different counties have different ordinances. Like, there's certain places like in the five boroughs in New York where you can't have like pythons, mm-hmm. and then you can't have scorpions there. And it's like, if you didn't know, if you just moved there and you had your pet and you move, or, you know, you've got your small collection and you move there, you could become a criminal overnight. And it's like, because you've got a couple pet snakes, you know, and it's just ridiculous. So that's something that you have to take into consideration, whether you have a very diverse collection or even just a couple animals. You know, you should always look into the regulations in the area where you live. Because that does play a huge role in, you know, what direction you might even want to go in.
That's very true. And it's also important to recognize, too, that like in the state of Mass, for example, because we're both Mass boys,
yep.
for the most part, they don't really see reptiles as animals.
No.
They're this, like, just whatever kind of thing. There are very, very few regulations that kind of surround reptiles. Of course, there's like restricted species like crocodilians and venomous and retics and blah blah blah, and some of that I think is BS. And you know, but I will say Mass is one of the few states, and I will credit a lot of this to the New England Herpetological Society and the relationship that they built with Fish and Game. Mass is one of the few states in the country that lessened certain species restrictions.
Yes.
Like years ago when chameleons used to require permits and green trees used to require permits and stuff. And that's no longer the case. you know, so if you create that network with your Fish and Wildlife Service or whatever, especially if they do have any input in your area with reptiles, you're like, hey, listen, like, you know, let's open up some dialogue on this. You make friends, essentially. Yep. You know, a lot of times that is very helpful, because most of these people, just like you were saying, they're just like, oh, snake, why do you want that? No, no, go ahead, get out of here.
Yep.
We don't want that. You know, and most of the time it's because they saw a show on Animal Planet, you know, and they got freaked out because they heard.
Anaconda.
Yeah, exactly. you know, so they don't understand, they don't know anything about it, and nor do they really want to be bothered. But if you kind of put yourself in that situation, you know, like I remember even hearing this at the Maine hearings, you know, like a lot of the Fish and Game officers and stuff that, you know, training on exotic reptiles, it doesn't happen.
Nothing. There is nothing.
You know, and if there is something, it's like, this is a ball python, this is a corn snake, you should be able to ID these.
Yep.
You know, but anything past that is non-existent. You know, so there were like these EPOs basically saying like, well, I know who they are because I go to them if I have to confiscate something that I can't ID.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's even a native species that they can't ID, you know, and you're like, man, you know, that was one of the things that with that Maine hearing, like, blew me away. I'm like, you want to add all these other species onto this restricted list? I'm hearing that your EPOs can't even ID a black rat snake. Yeah, like, what the hell, dude?
Can't even do milk snakes. You know? They're like, I don't know. I got to look up in this book.
Yeah, let me get my field guide from 1999.
Oof.
Yeah, and my Nature Valley granola bar to crunch on the side. Like, whew. Too far?
I have some very sensitive feelings around them. It was not good.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things. I moved from Massachusetts to Maine, and I had a decent collection of snakes and a decent collection of tarantulas. And almost all – well, when I lived there, all tarantulas were illegal in Maine. So I couldn't bring my 50 tarantulas that I had. I had to leave them with a friend in Massachusetts and pay them to – like, you know, he was actually really good. He said he didn't have to pay him. But, you know, I would have had to pay somebody to take care – of these animals while I tried to get permits. And I was working with the state at the time, and I was going to all the meetings with the Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. I was talking to their, you know, their game wardens and all this stuff. And I applied for permits. They knew I'm not some Yahoo. I was working with them on a monthly basis. You know, all this stuff. I sent them like $400 in permits, and they still denied me permits for all these things that I legally owned in Massachusetts that I just wanted to legally keep in Maine. So that's something that you really do have to consider. If you are not in a permanent spot, if you don't own a home and plan on living there the rest of your life, definitely something to consider, you know, looking around and seeing what the other regulations are around in the states or places where you're interested in going. Because mm-hmm. a lot of places, it's very strict, especially here in New England. I mean, around the country, it might be a little bit different. But,
yeah.
You know, New England in particular is very, very strict on what you can and cannot own. And then there's Pennsylvania, who's like,
yoo-hoo! Everything.
Yeah,
everything.
Whatever. Yeah, as long as it's not native, do whatever you want.
Yep. And then, you know, and I mean, then there's states like the Carolinas that are, that there's really no overarching state regulations. It's all counties. County based. And you can literally be in one county where there's a restriction on every exotic animal. And then the next county over, you know, literally might be 5 minutes down the road. No regs at all. Yeah. Nothing. You can own an alligator. You can own a crocodile. You can own a king cobra. You can own a ball python, whatever, you know. So the more research you do, the better. Somebody had asked something, and I missed it.
Well, I mean, that's one thing that you definitely have to. And then if you ever do consider moving a small collection in comparison to moving a large collection is completely different. Me and Jeremy were talking about this the other day when he was talking about moving his animal. He's like, oh, you know, I've got 100 and some odd snakes. How many pillowcases do I own? Because you might have to go and buy out every pillowcase at Walmart or you know, wherever your local place is that would carry such a thing. You might have, if you find yourself having to move short notice, you know, and you don't have 100 pillowcases to handle all your reptiles or 100 moving containers to put your reptiles in, that is a problem. It's a very swift problem that you'll have to deal with. And then things like power outages in New England or in the northern part of the country, if your power goes out, what is your plan? If you've got a large collection, do you have a backup generator to heat the room? Do you have you got to have a backup plan, because if you get caught with your pants around your ankles when the power goes out in the middle of a snowstorm, that's not good.
Yep.
Super, super not good. And then I even think about down south when they have hurricanes and everything, if they lose their power or if their water levels start to rise and they have to evacuate, what is your plan? If you've got a large collection of reptiles, you have to take those things into consideration. You have to. You know, it sucks to think about if everything goes wrong, but you have to be prepared if something goes wrong. I saw that one of the companies overseas, DDI, they had a huge fire yesterday, and burned their whole reptile room. And it's like,
oh man,
it's something horrible that you don't ever want to think about, but it has to be on your radar. If you're thinking about having a whole room full of reptiles, you have to have safeguards set up so that if some heating element goes off or you know, some way to handle it if things start to go bad. Because if you've got one tank and your light goes off, I mean, yeah, one light could potentially set a house on fire. But if you've got 300 lights and you've got heat tape on this entire wall and you've got bins and thermostats and all this stuff, it's statistically more likely to happen as opposed to if you've got a couple animals and everything. And I was thinking about it, like, when I move, I want to set up a, you know, some sort of like ring camera or something for my reptile room so I can constantly have an eye going there to keep an eye on what's going on inside that room. Because, you know, heaven forbid something happens, you want to be able to get on top of it as soon as possible.
Yeah.
As soon as possible.
Jessica has been asking a lot of really great questions. She just asked another one. Speaking of backups, how many redundancies does Nerd have? And if we can elaborate a little bit. Nerd has some massive generator power.
They could power like a city block for a few days.
Yeah.
At least.
So that's like the immediate go-to. But, you know, I mean, then there's also we have a bunch of various kinds of thermostats throughout the building. We've been slowly making a switch over to one in particular. And the primary reason for that has been if it fails, for whatever reason, it fails in the off position.
Yes.
And that's a massive one. And it's actually interesting that more of the thermostats in the industry don't do that. They just set off an alarm or something, which is cool, but unless that's like connected to your phone or something, and if you're not home, then you don't know that there's anything going on. Mm-hmm. So we've been really liking those. I switched over most of my thermostats to those as well, just for that reason. If it fails, it's just going to shut off. You know, it's a lot easier to deal with reptiles that have gotten a little too cold than reptiles that have now been cooked. Mm-hmm. you know, so that's a big thing to take into consideration. You know, and again, I'm trying to avoid naming any particular brand just because I don't want to dig at anybody or any particular brand. Cause that's not the purpose of what I'm saying, but you know, those are things you want to kind of have in the back of your mind, is like, okay, if this thermostat fails, what's the built-in redundancy for it? You know, is it going to protect my animals?
Yeah, and some people will set up backup thermostats, so they'll hook their thermostat into another thermostat as like a quick backup. Yep. But if you're looking at like any of the Herbstat thermostats, they're like $100 and some odd. So a $200 backup thing, you know, it might save you, you know, thousands of dollars in animals and all that sort of stuff and care and everything. But a lot of people are not willing to put that upfront cost to have that thing going.
Yeah.
So it is what it is, you know, when it comes to that sort of stuff.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And that's that's another thing to just think about with a larger collection versus a smaller collection is if you've got a large collection, right, you've got multiple racks, especially if you're doing like Freedom Breeder racks or just anything that's a larger rack unit, and you have multiples of those and you're moving those, you need to be aware of your thermostat probes when you're jostling cords around, making sure you're not knocking plugs out of sockets and stuff, where you can either have a thermostat end up being totally shut off, or if a probe gets pulled off of some heat tape, now it's just going to cook whatever is there. You know, and that's I think that's a problem a fair bit of people have probably experienced at one point or another, because it's really easy for a probe to get yanked out, or you know, a tape, if you're going to tape your probe somewhere, the tape just fails after a long period of time, or it gets loose enough where the probe can just slide right out, and then next thing you know, you have a cooked rack of snakes. It's happened to me in the past. One of my old carpet python racks, I had moved a bin incorrectly into the rack, and it actually knocked the probe off, and I didn't know it until the next day. And I walked past this rack and I just felt this blast of heat, and I was like, what the heck? And basically lost all but two snakes in that whole rack, and I was devastated. you know, but I mean, it's just, you have to be aware of those things. And, you know, regardless of if you have a large collection or a small collection, you want to be aware of these things. But it's potentially a little bit more possible to happen to you if you've got a lot of racks, especially if you move racks or anything like that in your room. If you're going to rearrange something, you know, it's a lot easier to deal with, like, a Reptile Basics rack that you can basically just pick up by yourself, move to wherever it needs to go, and then you're done, versus like a 30 plus slot Freedom Breeder that you need somebody else's help to pull away from the wall and then wheel wherever it's got to go and make sure you unplug everything, all that stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely tougher. The larger scale you go, the more things can go wrong, and that's something that you definitely have to think about. You know, on every single level, when it comes to feeding, when it comes to heating, when it comes to your, you know, your heating bill, your electricity bill is going to be higher if you've got a ton of snakes or reptiles in general, especially if you got bearded dragons and stuff like that. I can't even imagine.
I feel sorry for you, bro.
A ton of bearded dragons. No. I'm like, oh my goodness. Your lighting bill must be absurd. I think about all the 100 watt bulbs that are just, oh,
no,
stresses me out.
Nope. First of the upfront cost for all those lights,
yeah,
and then the electric bill on top of it,
yeah,
and it's like, oh,
oof.
Sorry, bro.
Yeah, it varies because, like, I mean, people down south have it a little bit easier because I know a lot of people who live on the southern part of the country. They can do outdoor enclosures for a lot of their stuff, so they don't have to do as much. But for people in the northern part of the country, you know, your heating bill and your lighting bill is going to be significantly higher than your average person if you've got a decent number of reptiles. If you've got a couple of reptiles, it might not be that different. But when you've got 50, 100 different reptiles, you'll see a huge difference in your electric bill. And back in the day, that used to be one of the things where, like, I know that we had the electrical company show up at our door and they're like, are you guys doing illegal things here, like growing weed? And we're like, no, we've got a lot of reptiles here. And then the guy comes in, he's like, reptiles? They're like, yeah, come on, we'll give you the tour, show them around. That's a snake. And you're like, yeah, I know.
Which is also a reptile.
Do you believe it or not? Believe it or not.
Fun fact.
Yeah, until they get to the tarantulas and they're like, nope, that's where I'm done. Out. And they take off and leave. So it is what it is, you know.
Yep.
But if you've got a couple reptiles, it's not going to be as big of a commitment for money. It's not going to be as big a commitment for time. You can definitely do a little bit, you know, more when it comes to care if you've got a couple animals. Unless you've got, like, an exorbitant amount of free time and you've got a ton of animals, then you can do whatever you
whatever
want.
Whatever you want. But yeah, exactly.
If you just are independently wealthy, you know,
I envy that.
Yeah, you should hire me to take care of your reptiles.
Yeah, right, exactly. So Black Tie Royals just dropped a comment in here. That's another good part of this topic, too. Disease control becomes a much larger issue on a larger scale.
Yep.
I know two people who recently had Nido hit their collections, and they ended up spending a couple of grand on testing for everything. So
wait.
Yeah, exactly.
Just wait.
So certainly biosecurity and maintaining as close to sterile environment as possible is helpful. But also, let's be real, we're dealing with living creatures that poop and pee and bite and all these things. So it's damn near impossible to be lab grade sterile and clean. But you can certainly take the right precautions as far as disinfectants and being able to clean tools after you're using them. You know, especially with things like, you know, nidovirus is certainly still a hot button issue in the industry, and it's frustrating to me just because we still know so little about it. You know, so all the tests, like, not to frighten anybody, but all the testing that's being done, there's new things are popping up all the time. So the primers get changed often as they find new species or new strains. So unless you are consistently testing your entire collection, you will never be able to say for sure that you have a Nido negative collection or whatever. And then there's, of course, also the instance where if an animal is not shedding enough virus material to be picked up on a PCR test, you get a false negative. And, you know, it might consistently test negative until some stressor makes it blow up, and then it tests positive. So nidovirus is really one of those, like, wild cards when it comes to that. And it's primarily just because it's so new. You know, and it's probably the biggest thing that's frustrating to me about that is everybody's so willing to point the finger. And it's like,
they don't know yet.
Nobody knows.
We don't know yet.
Like, nobody has all the answers for it. So yeah, it doesn't make any sense. You know, and of course, not saying that to downplay anything. We've certainly talked. We should probably try to get Steve Tillis back
on
the
show, podcast,
For some updates, some Nido updates and other updates from him. But, you know, learning what I've learned over the last year or so from him and everybody else, either at UF or Fishhead, about nidoviruses, it really just makes you think and realize, okay, well, we should just be doing more on the biosecurity front as keepers, you know, be it, you know, wearing gloves in between working with snakes, or just being conscious. You know, you use a hook on a snake, dunk that hook in a bleach sink or something before you go, or chlorhexidine or something before you go to the next snake. You know, if you are using a table to put your bins on, if your snake's on that table, just do a quick wipe down of some disinfectant before you go to the next snake. You know, things that we often don't bother thinking about just because we're like, I just got to get this done. I've got a lot of stuff. You know, you get into a rhythm of it. But if you start to implement these things into your rhythm, then it just becomes second nature again. You know, so not to go down a Nido tangent, but it is important. I think we should try to, I'll send a message to Steve and see if we can get him on in the next couple of weeks.
There's been some huge developments in nidovirus that are literally going to make every single one of you, I mean, if you're paying attention, if you're, you know, understanding what it's about, it's going to make you very concerned.
Like, yeah, and just, it's
and it is what it is. Like, it may have a very heavy impact, or it could be something more benign. It's like nidovirus. Just because something tests positive for a nidovirus doesn't mean that the animal's going to die. It doesn't mean that it's 100% going to get sick. Like, there's so many different variables when it comes to that, and that's something that we're just really learning about right now. So the more information that comes out about that as we go, the more that that's going to evolve. And I think the reptile hobby is in for, you know, some eye-opening experiences when it comes to that. There's over 100 different strains of nidovirus that they've confirmed. It's probably closer to 200 now, because when we talked to them in February, they were like, yeah, it's over 100 strains now.
Yeah.
And we're finding new ones every week. Like, we're finding, like, 3 to 5 new strains every week. And I'm like, oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's what frustrated me, like, hearing that, because it's like, man, hi, Dan. you know, we don't know enough.
Yeah.
You know, so for everybody to just be jumping the gun and being like, these people have nidovirus is absolutely terrible and unacceptable and blah, 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 blah. You know, to then basically learn, like, well, if you've got more than 10 snakes,
you probably have at least one strain of nidovirus.
Yeah, exactly. In your collection. You know, and that made a lot of people shut up real fast.
I don't know. I still hear a lot of people talking, so.
Well, no, I mean, of course, the people are still going to talk, but it stopped a bit of the finger pointing. And made there be a little bit more like, wait, what'd you say?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what needed to happen, because for so long it was just
gonna
like
be pandemonium.
It's you terrible person, you know. I don't know if I would do a live stream with Steve, only because there would be a million questions that would get plagued, especially with the information that he would be dropping. So I think what we can do is, if we plan for it, I'll post a story here on the Reptile Talk Instagram with a question thing, and then we'll take everybody's questions, and then we can just kind of ask him, just so we can keep it a little bit more controlled and people's questions don't get lost.
Or we can do it on our OnlyFans, and the people who are supporting us, then they can ask the questions.
Also true. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah,
more.
We might do that. But, I mean, all those things are going to play a role in, you know, if you're making a conscious decision of whether or not you want a large collection or a small collection. You know, biosecurity is a huge thing that plays a factor. Mm-hmm. You know, how much money you're spending, how much time you're spending, all plays a huge role in whether or not you're going to want to do that. And I see a lot of people who think that they want to get a big collection, and then they get a big collection, and they're like, this is too much for me. I need to, you know, cut back. I need to cut, cut down. And there's nothing really wrong with that, but I do encourage people to really put some heavy thought into if they want that bigger collection and to invest that amount of time before you do it. Because these are living animals, and you don't want to just, like, get something in, you know, have a bunch of stuff shipped into you and get all these racks and all this stuff, and then, you know, you find out, oh, well, I don't have any time
to spend. Me. Yeah.
Yeah. And you just, you know, have to get rid of it all. It's not worth it to do that. I usually encourage people, if they're going to head towards a larger collection, to slowly build your way up from a smaller collection, so you can kind of take it in steps as opposed to just jumping into the deep end. Because, you know, not being able to find feeders, like, notoriously, ball python breeding time nationwide, you cannot find medium rats, because that's what size adult ball pythons eat. So if you keep any other species that eats that size rat,
you're screwed.
Yeah, around ball python breeding time, you will not find medium rats, frozen thawed or otherwise, for the most part.
Yep.
During hatching season,
you will not find hopper mice.
Hopper mice and small adult mice. You will not be able to get them.
Nope.
Rodent places are going to up their prices on them, and you're going to pay out the nose to get them. And that is something that if you've got a couple animals, you might notice that sort of thing. But if you've got 100 snakes and 30 of them eat medium-sized rats, and now it's your breeding season and you can't get medium-sized rats, that is a bad thing. It's not good. And if you've only got a couple snakes, that's not something that you would ever think of. But if you've got a big collection of snakes, that's something you constantly have to be planning for. I would go to the expos, and I would just have a couple $100 just for feeders. When I was living at home, I was like, dude, I would just show up with, you know, $100 to maybe buy a steak, and then like $300
for rodents,
so I could fill up my freezer. And
do you remember in the White Plains show, as soon as you walked in, there's that guy right to the right.
Yes.
I remember I basically bought him out, like, right at the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. I had a buddy of mine connected me with him, so I could get a little bit of a better deal. Yep. But, you know, I was like, what do you got for this size, this size, this size, and this size? And he was like, oh, I have X number of this, X number of that, X number of that. I was like, cool, I'll take it all. And he was like, what?
Yep.
This is like beginning of the show.
First thing. Yeah.
And I was like, I know you're going to sell out.
And I was like, hey, do you have these sizes? He's like, no, I'm sold out, bro. Sorry.
It's probably me. Yep. It was either him or Komodo. And I think for that show, he had slightly better prices. And yeah. I was like, well.
Yeah. Dude, that is something that I didn't anticipate when I was getting a bunch of snakes was how much space I needed for frozen feeder, because I was feeding everything frozen thawed. The amount, like, my parents were so pissed when I was living at home, because they were like, you've taken over our freezer in the house, and we cannot let guests open the freezer and see a giant trash bag full of rats. You need to buy your own freezer.
So, oh, see, my favorite part of that was I'd put the rodents right on the door of the freezer and just tell somebody to go grab ice for their drink.
No! My parents, they would lose their crap. So my parents are like, you got to get a freezer. So I went on Craigslist when I was like, what, 18, 20 years old. And I went to some sketchy basement in Boston and picked up this chest freezer. This guy was selling for $50. And oh my God, I'm surprised I didn't get murdered.
Oof.
But after I got that chest freezer, it was great, because then when I bought my, you know, $300 worth of rats, plunked them down in the chest freezer. And then my mom was like, oh, an extra freezer. Let me put the ice cream on top. And I was like, listen here. You told me to get the freezer. It's my freezer.
Yep.
She still has that freezer.
Does she? Oh, man. Let's see. Becky D56 just threw another important thing in there. In addition to the time commitment to care for the reptiles, people need to remember that snakes can definitely live for a long time. It's not a hamster that lives for 3 to 5 years.
No, it's a 20-plus year commitment. And then also, you got to think about how you're going to house these animals when they get bigger.
Yep.
The one that really, like, boggles my mind and grinds my gears is people who get, like, a ton of reticulated pythons. And I'm like, where are you going to put all these giant snakes? Like, I don't understand. Like, if you've got, like, 5 reticulated pythons. That is this size room right here.
Yeah.
Stacked.
Gone. Yeah, gone.
It's gone. That's it. There's nothing else you can put in that room. That's it. Just those snakes.
Yep.
And then I see people who have got like 30 reticulated pythons. I'm like, what are you? Do you have a full basement for these snakes? Are you planning on just keeping them in like 4-foot enclosures and hoping for the best? Like, what is your plan? Because if you've got a ton of reticulated pythons, that is a huge commitment of space, time, money. The enclosures themselves are probably going to cost you $1,000 each.
Yep.
Minimum for your adults. You're just throwing that around for 15, 20, 30 reticulated pythons?
Cool, bro.
Nah, man. I mean, that's something you gotta think about. I mean, if you got that kind of money, hey, ball out.
Yeah, if you got it.
Go, boo boo. You do you. But, like, for the average person to think about, you know, making 8 or 10 foot enclosures by 4 foot by 2 foot or whatever, you know, to adequately house an adult reticulated python, that's a lot of money. And they're like, yeah, but it's like $100 reticulated python. I'm like, I understand that. But it's going to go in a probably $100 setup for now, and then a $300 4-foot cage, and then a $700 6-foot cage, and then a $900 bigger, like, final cage.
Yeah.
That's how much money. That's what, $4,000 off your $100 reticulated python?
Because
you're thinking, oh, the snake itself is not that expensive. You have to think long term where that animal's going to go. Like, it's one thing to have a bunch of baby snakes and, oh, cool, I've got, you know, 30 Borneo short-tailed pythons. Where are you putting 30 adult Borneo short-tailed pythons? I'm asking myself that question right now. I'm not posing that for the audience.
Legit. Somebody just, I totally just, like, messed
exited out. Sorry. Ugh.
ABG reptiles. Okay, I wanted to make sure I got to that question because I think it's a good one. It said, at what point do you feel that breeding rodents would be worth the time/money investment? I think if it, once you kind of start getting around that, I'll say 20 to 30 snake mark, maybe, if, especially if you're thinking of breeding.
Yeah, if you're breeding 30 snakes, I would say if you're, I mean, who's keeping 50 snakes and not breeding them? But, like, honestly, my cutoff would probably be 50 because, like, 30 or 40, if you have a decent job, you can afford to pay to get your rodents.
That's
fair.
I know people
who have, like, 30 snakes and they buy all their feeders. And I'm like, wow, you're crazy. But, you know, for the average person, it's a lot of, like, the rodents are more work than the actual reptiles themselves, like the snakes themselves.
So, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
That's another time commitment for your big collection time commitment. Like,
yeah, I mean, if you can, the most important thing when it comes to that, I mean, this kind of dabbles into going past thinking about just keeping reptiles for the sake of keeping reptiles and thinking with a little bit more business savviness.
Yes.
To your thought process. You know, you want to look at your time commitment just for dealing with the reptiles. You can assume it's going to be 2 or 3 times the amount of time to deal with rodents. Because, you know, I'm going to assume if you're going to get like one rack of rodents, you're not going to have another rack of rodents to just transfer things around when things need to be cleaned and whatever. So you've got to be able to take rats out, put them in somewhere so you can clean a bin. Sometimes those bins get really gross. Do that, you know, whatever. So there's a little bit more that goes into that. And then thinking about financially, okay, if it costs you, let's just say $500 every 2 months to feed all of your snakes. Okay, so $250 a month to feed all of your snakes. Now look at what does it cost per month to get bedding and food for those rodents. You know, let's say maybe it's $120.
Yeah.
Okay, so for $120 a month, now you can essentially feed
your
collection. So it'll save you a little bit of money.
Your time.
But then your time commitment is then what needs to go into it, because every day you need to be checking stuff for, you know, potential chew outs or anything like that.
Water lines and food. Yeah,
making sure that everything's got water, all that stuff. So there's a lot more that goes into it, you know. And if you're thinking larger scale for rodents, it becomes a full-time job very quickly. You know, just thinking, you know, I think about if I was to start breeding rodents, I'd have to, I'd want to also be able to sell rodents so that I can make some money off of what I'm doing. So I need to be able to feed 150 snakes every week for the most part, and then produce enough to sell. So let's say I'd want to have 300 rodents
adults, a week. Minimum.
You know, yeah. So I've got to be able to have enough animals to produce what I need for my own collection and sell. But I've also got to figure out, okay, well, am I going to only sell frozen feeders? So am I going to, you know, euthanize large amounts of rodents? Then I need big freezers.
Yep.
That takes up space and is not cheap. You know, and if I'm not going to do frozen feeders, am I going to have space for all the potential surplus? You know, you might not sell everything you produce right away. So do I have space for all that? Then you've got to take care of all that. You've got to feed all that, clean all that. So you really do need to break things down into numbers. You know, as much as for some reason the industry like hates to do that, especially when you're like teetering on that level of like, I have enough snakes, you know, I'm making some money off of this, but like, I don't want to think about it as a business. Well, sorry, bucko, you know, you have to, you know, and if you start breeding rodents on a large enough scale, then you might want to ask yourself, okay, well, am I doing this in the basement of my house?
No.
No, you're probably going to want to do this. Right.
In a shed.
You're probably going to do this in a shed on your building. So then you've got to think about electricity going to another building so you can keep that temperature consistent. You can vent it out, you know, like so many other things go into it. You know, if you have one rack of rodents, you could probably maintain that in a room of your house with no big deal. But if you're trying to do multiple racks of rodents of various sizes, you need to think about that a lot. So it really comes down to what you're working with, what you're willing to spend, what your time commitment availability is
for
when you're doing that.
For sure. And for honestly, if you're thinking about doing rodents, I mean, you can do, you know, part and part and, you know, buy some of your rodents and breed some of your rodents, mm-hmm. depending on what your area looks like. I find that if you're breeding snakes, you probably are going to want to breed rodents as well, so that you've got all the little sizes that you might need. And, you know, that one picky feeder that wants to have a live pinky mouse or, you know, whatever for a baby corn snake, or, you know, a live hopper mouse for a little short tail or ball python, you know, to be able to have that option for your babies is huge, because it could be the difference between getting an animal started and not getting an animal started. And so if you're thinking about breeding, I think it's a huge thing to consider, and I encourage people to get those live rodents going. But if you are not doing it as breeding, who really cares? Most of the time you can get your animals over to frozen thaw.
Yep, exactly.
And then, you know, if you talk about like people like Framscams who do the chameleons, and they are breeding a ton of different feeders over there, and they're they're really into it, and that's saving them so much money. Because if you're buying, I mean, buying 1,000 count of crickets is not an exorbitant amount of money on a regular basis, but if you're doing 1,000 count of dubia roaches or a, you know, 100 count of superworms or that sort of stuff, that adds up
fast.
Super quickly for, you know, leopard geckos and bearded dragons and, you know, any other type of reptile that you might have. Insect costs can really add up. Dubia roaches are worth their weight in gold pretty much. And it's ridiculous, but the more that you really look into that cost analysis, it really can determine for you whether or not you're willing to make that commitment for a larger collection, or whether you'd like to keep it on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
Just the numbers.
It's true. You really do have to think about the numbers when it comes to small scale versus large scale reptile keeping. Cause there's so much that goes into it. I know, and we'll probably go over our time. Obviously I'm not getting cut off on Instagram, so that's awesome. But one of the things to again think about is like, what, when you're thinking about kind of growing your collection, you're thinking about time. And the other thing you want to think about too is, you know, like I've talked about this on the podcast before, when I was 18 going to Brian Barchek's place, and you know, when I was growing up, all I wanted to be was a big scale reptile breeder. Yeah. Like that was like my dream. I was like, this is what's happening. Sorry, Mom. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not going to go to be a doctor.
You're an OnlyFans now.
Yeah, yeah. I have an OnlyFans. Sorry, Mom. Yeah. But you know, I was like, this is it. This is it. You know, and because I can remember like coming up to Nerd, you come up for a day and you see all these super cool animals and blah, blah, blah. And you hang out and you do whatever. And it's like, man, this is awesome. This is the greatest thing in the world. And then going to Barcheck's place and seeing the daily grind. I was there for a week. For anybody that hasn't heard the story, I went out there for a week. And it wasn't to just hang out. It was to get the, like, I wanted the full experience. And it was my graduation gift from my mom, which was honestly at that point in time the greatest thing in the freaking world to me. Hey, random shout out to the Herpetoculture magazine. I'm rocking their shirt right now.
Hey!
So going to Barcheck, seeing that daily grind in and out, I was like, ooh.
This okay. is a lot.
maybe there's a little bit more to this. I think the biggest thing that was a deterrent for me wasn't necessarily the sheer amount of snakes. You throw me in a room with 10,000 snakes, I'm in heaven regardless. Yeah, I can do that, you know what I mean? Like, that's the easy part. But dealing with staff, you know, that's always a headache. You know, I feel like it's safe to say most people in the reptile industry are not necessarily people.
No.
You know, they'd much rather just deal with their snakes, and that's pretty much it. So dealing with staff and then a large staff at that, I was like, you know, and if one staff member suddenly becomes a problem and then you need to get rid of them and dealing with that, that's not wonderful.
And finding replacements and all that stuff.
Finding replacements, exactly. You know, and it, like, that's a little easier if you've just got like corn snakes and ball pythons, but if you've got a vast array of species, you know, from corn snakes to retics, you know, you can't just find any Joe Schmo off the side of the street and be like, hey, here's 150 retics, have fun with that. Yeah, like, that just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to think about that. The other thing for me that kind of plugged it into my brain at kind of where I want to get with my collection is I don't want to be responsible for somebody's paycheck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If especially knowing the industry after almost 20 years of doing shows and being out talking to people, you know, knowing Kevin and Barcheck and like all these people, like hearing some of the massive triumphs of income and then hearing the detrimental, like, I want to go cry for a week, you know, financial things. Like, I don't want to have to deal with that for myself already, but I want to make that commitment because I am comfortable with that. But as soon as I throw somebody else into the mix, I'm no longer comfortable with that.
Yeah.
So it's like, I know that this industry moves in waves and has its ups and downs. And if I'm struggling, I don't want to be the reason somebody else has to struggle. So that was where I was like, okay, if I can't maintain the collection by myself,
that's too big.
Then it's too big, you know? And it's like, yeah, sure. If somebody hits me up and be like, hey, do you need help? You know, I'll come by once a week and help you go through waters and stuff. Cool, man. Yeah, I'll throw you $100. Yep. You know, come help me. That's, you know, that's fine. But if I can't get through a week of work in my reptile collection without being like, oh my God, or falling ridiculously behind, then I'm out.
Yeah.
Yep. I got to downsize.
Yep. So, Jeremy, we're actually winding down our time here.
We are.
On the actual podcast. People in the live stream are still hanging out.
Yeah.
But I'm going to flip the script here a little bit. And I'm going to say, what in the realm of reptiles right now has got you excited about reptiles? Yes.
Not
yes.
The question.
Because there's so many cool things that I've been seeing on, like, social media and stuff. And then, like, all the stuff that we're doing and everything.
But
I already know what your answer is.
What is my answer?
Mex-Mex.
Oh, that certainly does have me very excited about reptiles. That actually wasn't what I was going to say, though.
Really?
Although I am very excited about my Mex-Mex project. I forgot who posted it now, and it's because you asked me the question.
I know.
Somebody I just saw hatched out a massive clutch of Melendorphi.
Yeah, it's Zirkle. Zirkle.
It's Zirkle. Yes, that's right. And I was like, I was losing it. If you guys don't know who the Zirkles are, you got to find, they work with some of the more obscure rat snake species. Just colubrid species in general.
Check them out on Instagram. Zirkle check Reptiles. Search them and they'll come up.
Yes. They have some amazing animals. But I saw this big clutch of Melendorphi and I was like, God, oh, it's so cool. Yes. So that has me super geeked. Certainly my Mex-Mex project has me very excited.
Mex-Mex king snakes.
Some nice ones. Mm. Some really nice ones. Mm. All right, Mr. What? Dude guy.
No. I asked you. No. You'll ask me next time.
I can't ask you?
You can ask me.
Okay, what in the realm of reptile has you excited about reptiles?
I actually wasn't prepared for this.
That's
so.
Right!
Those Melendorphi were cool
pretty
as shit.
Cool. That was my answer, though.
You know what really got me pumped, and it's not reptile-related, really? Trace Harden had some Pocklotheria egg sac, an ornamental tarantula egg sac, and I was like, oh my god, those are my favorite kind of tarantulas, so I was just like super geeked about that, and I was like, oh man, I need to get some more of those, because those things are awesome, and they're just so cool, and all these little babies inside the enclosure, and I was like, oh, that's so exciting. So it's not really reptile related, and then he just upgraded his Kaiser Newts too, and I was like, oh, that's
cool.
Freaking cool. So I'll say that was my thing. So, Jeremy, if people want to find out more about you and the things that you're doing, where are they going to find you?
All right. You can find me here on Instagram at Brassman Reptiles, Facebook at Brassman Reptiles, YouTube at Brassman Reptiles, Patreon at Brassman Reptiles, Twitter at Brassman Rep. And I think that's it. How about you, Rob?
People want to find me and the stuff that I'm doing, check me out on Instagram at Rob is Creeping It Real, on Twitter sometimes at Rob is Creeping. Don't add me on Facebook. And make sure that you follow Reptile Talk on Instagram.
Bam.
And make sure you check out our OnlyFans, because we are going to be offering kind of like behind the scenes, like exclusive content for people who follow us on OnlyFans. We're going to be sending you free stickers. Well, if you sign up for a month, we will send you stickers for Reptile Talk for everyone who signs up. And we're going to be posting some of our breeding projects and all that sort of stuff that we won't be sharing on Instagram and other places. So make sure you check us out, and we'll see you next time.